Good evening and welcome to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
I'm Ian Tiny Morris.
And I'm Simon Sansbury.
And welcome. Last podcast before the end of term.
Yes. We've brought all our favourite games in.
Well, and I guess that's the question, isn't it? We looked last week at the full council meeting on Tuesday. And with 12 or 11 notices of motion and some other fairly meaty topics, it would appear that the sweepstake was out as to, you know, what time Wednesday morning it was going to finish. And if you add to that the searing heat of Tuesday, there was genuine fear for some of our councillors. But I guess we'll explore today whether searing heat and the prospect of heat exhaustion focuses the mind, as I believe everybody was out by about half past nine.
Yeah, 6¾ hours the meeting was, considering there were, 13 items on the agenda, and one of those items, which was the notices of motion, had 11 items. And there were also five questions from members. So it was not exactly an empty agenda, but they managed to sweep through it. So I don't know, maybe it's an argument for making the council chamber less comfortable in future so that people get through, are motivated to get through things. I don't know. We've got some councillors on, so maybe we can ask them whether they'd consent to that or not.
We'll ask them firsthand. And first, an apology to the listeners. If my voice is not sounding its usual lovely, waxy and lyrical tone, It was a day of cricket yesterday, and I had to skip at the side. So, that's basically 5 hours of shouting in an enthusiastic way. So, the vocal cords are not quite as premium as they could be today.
Okay. Well, we shall bear that in mind. It's not like you're being sponsored by some sort of chocolate manufacturer, and you're trying to earn extra money from voiceovers. But
Trying to influence. So shall we start off with we haven't been able to capture him live, but earlier today you headed off with the virtual microphone to have a chat with Matt Winnington from the Lib Dem to talk about principally the motion that was about the council bringing more GPs into the city and possibly hiring some themselves. We had our reservations.
When we kicked it about last week, we did kind of question how the council would be able to make any difference to that themselves if local practices haven't been able to recruit GPs themselves. Matt managed to get into a bit of the detail, I think it's going to be a good idea if we can get him back on after the summer break to give us a bit of an update on how things are going with that one. But yeah, let's hear what Matthew's got to say.
Thanks very much for joining us. What's the motion about, and why is it needed?
Okay, so it's very much about in the situation as we find it in Portsmouth now. So the Nuffield Trust has found that Portsmouth has the lowest number of GPs per person population in the country, and it's fallen from second worst to the worst. So previously Hull was the worst in the country, and now we are. And so it's based on that in terms of that recent evidence, but it's also based on, and the background to it is very much based on experiences I and other campaigns for Lib Dems have had during the election campaign that we had earlier this year. But also, and I am in my professional area of where I work in the adult social care sector, and the feedback that we've had from some of our clients and carers within that area has very much been about this current situation with having real issues accessing GPs and being able to have the support from their GPs that they feel they need. But that all obviously fits in with the fact that we now know we've got this statistical thing that we have the lowest number of GPs per head of population in the entire country, which is just a real problem. And so the whole motion is about recognising that fact. What can we do with GPs and other primary care? Because let's not forget, primary care is not just GPs, it's pharmacists, physiotherapists, and other healthcare professionals as well, who are there to support you as your initial contact with the healthcare system. And how can we work with them to improve things in terms of access to GPs and primary care in general, but also what can we do about helping GPs be recruited, and indeed, can we actually recruit them and employ them ourselves?
How is it that you think the council is going to have more success than existing practices are with regard to that? What can they, could the council bring to bear that perhaps hasn't worked elsewhere?
It's GPs are a really tricky one. I mean, the GP model, the model for GPs being employed and indeed having their own practices, goes back to 1948. It's pretty much unchanged since then. And it is very difficult for third parties to employ GPs, which is one of the issues. So therefore, you can't. So perhaps if you just want to set up a practice, it's virtually impossible. Or it's very, very difficult. And indeed, the way that it works, and we had this when we had the motion 2.5 years ago, which is during research for that motion, it was found out effectively we're all owned by our GPs. It's they own their list. To set up a new practice, they have effectively, you have to get a GP or GPs to relinquish part of their list. And that has a financial impact on them, because if you have less people on your list, it has some impact on your funding, etc. So it's a difficult thing. But also within GP practices, one of the issues is you have to have partners. So in terms of if it's a traditional setup GP practice, you have to have partners. So that means you have to have a core group of GPs who effectively are the owners of the business. So GPs might fundamentally be independent contractors, but most of them, especially now, they club together to create practices together, and they own that business. But they're responsible for everything. They're responsible for the building. They're responsible for all of those aspects. There's a huge amount of paperwork. It's much more than it used to be. And therefore, it's a huge bureaucratic burden. And one of the issues why we've had the mergers of practices around the city over the last few years is very much because you've had people have retired from becoming partners, or people who just don't want to be partners anymore. So they move on and they just want to be a salary GP. So it's that salary GP bit that, if the council was able to, would be really helpful. Because what you could do is you could employ GPs who could perhaps be support other practices around the city, or you could help a practice out by employing them directly. There's a lot of legal stuff, because of course to be able to employ GPs, you'd need to have that funding stream to get that, which in the same way, so effectively you'd need to take some NHS money to employ the GPs, and that's quite a bureaucratic process. So one of the things we're really asking about in the letter to that the leader of the council was sent is, one of the things is make it much easier for that to happen, so you're not stuck in this old way of working and this really bureaucratic way to even get the funding to be able to employ GPs. But for our practices around the city, that might well have another pathway that you can get GPs in. So it wouldn't be instead of, it would be in addition to, because I think the real point there is it's not the recruitment retention of GPs we have in the city is not going to be solved by a magic bullet. But what it does need is support from the centre, from national government. And one of the things that we think would help, or certainly might well help, is that if we could employ them as a council, because also our bureaucracy within the council could support that. Whereas if you're a GP practice, the more GPs you have, the more admin you have and all that kind of stuff. So we're a big organisation. We can absorb that within a much bigger area. Whereas if you're especially if you're a smaller GP practice in the city, recruiting GPs and going through that process is actually quite a bureaucratic burden on what is effectively a small business. And so that could be something there. It might be that rather than us doing directly, as we, I'm going to come in a minute to, I think we're going to come in a minute to what we're doing next.
Yeah.
But one of the things might be is that it fundamentally, we might not say, okay, maybe us employing them directly might not be, especially if they don't change legislation, might not be the most practical solution. But there might be other things we can do as the council to support the GP practices in their recruitment as well, including the admin side.
Okay, no, thanks. There's a lot of layers to it that I don't think probably most people understand, and where it's essentially, like you say, practices are essentially a private business. It's almost like a franchise model, isn't it? Where, you know, if you're essentially trying to carve up a bit of someone else's turf, and that sounds like a horrendous way to talk about patients, but essentially that's how the, if that's how the model operates, you've got to fight against that in order to be able to do the right thing for people, which is get more GPs in front of people. So
that is the thing, and it all goes back to 48, and it all goes back to the fact that, of course, the NHS came in and it replaced private doctors. So it was a way of placating doctors that say, well, you retain your list of patients.
Yeah.
You will get paid per patient effectively. You're given the resources that will fit your list. And that effectively is the underlying situation in terms of how much your practice gets of, mm-hmm. of support for to be able to do this. So that's that really goes right back to the fact that healthcare was nationalised, and it fundamentally hasn't changed since then. And even with this latest NHS reorganisation, which came into statutory footing on the 1st of July, it still hasn't changed. So we're still in that fundamental model of GP provision as we've been for the last 74 years.
Crikey. So what's next then? What's next on the action list?
So on the 4th of August, so in a week and a half's time, we are going to be having a conference, which is hosted by myself and Councillor Vernon Jackson. And we are bringing together GPs, pharmacists, physios, other primary care professionals, and obviously our colleagues from the council and from the wider integrated care system as well, which is the new body, which is the Hampshire Isle of Wight body that supports, that effectively is responsible for the NHS in our area. And really have that really open, frank conversation and say, what are the issues in terms of recruitment? But not just about that, it's also about to get across and help the people, the GPs and people within the healthcare sector understand the feelings of the local people in the city who are feeling like, I can't see a GP, it's really hard to get an appointment. See what the best practice is out there, because it's very noticeable that some GP surgeries are easier to get appointments than others, or certainly it feels that way. Other GP surgeries have a really poor reputation the response we have from people with those is that they feel like actual barriers are put in the way of having a face-to-face appointment, that it almost seems to have entirely gone to an online first, which during the pandemic, of course, that was the preference, because obviously you wanted to keep people away from surgeries if you could. But actually, as we know, though it might not have felt like it, there was always, all GP surgeries in the city did do face-to-face appointments throughout. I know that wasn't the case everywhere, but there were face-to-face appointments throughout the pandemic. Even if some of them were very few, there was every surgery. And the feeling is that some of the worst practice from the pandemic has been carried over to post-pandemic now, or not post-pandemic, but the situation we are now.
Yep.
And it's just about say, okay, how can we get a standard level of service across all our surgeries? What good practice could there be? What learning can there be? What kind of thing can we do differently? But also, what asks do we need to make of central government with the ministers? What asks do we need to make of for the for the integrated care system, our new NHS body who's responsible for the NHS in Hampshire, Isle of Wight. And what practically can we do together? What can we do from the council's point of view? How can we support that recruitment strategy, which they all need to do? How can we support retention? One of the really interesting things, I was talking to senior GP in the city just a couple of weeks ago, was the fact that you can train up GPs, and we have a really good training program at GP practices in the city, very successful one, produces lots of fantastic GPs. However, retaining at the end of their training period, very, very hard. And a lot of them are not necessarily leaving the city, but what they are doing is they're not staying in practice settings. They're becoming locums. And locums, if you're not familiar with the term, you would have come across it probably at some point. But effectively, they're your, if you think of teaching, they're like your supply doctors. Yeah. They're like supply teachers. You know, they fill in at practices for effectively when they need extra capacity, or doctors off sick or not well or not available for any reason. And because if you're a locum, you can make your own hours, you can decide what you want to work, it's not set. And also the standard model for paying locums is more expensive. And indeed, we know that some practices in the city, for example, and this is becoming more common practice nationally, a way to get locums is saying, well, we'll employ you as a locum, but or even as a salary GP, but you don't ever have to do a face-to-face appointment. But that's the level of desperation there is to get bums on seats.
Just to get someone in the door.
Just to get someone in. So it's this real balancing act here.
There's a lot there. So thank you for coming on and talking about that, Matthew. It's really, really interesting. We look forward to if you can come back on at a later date and let us know how that meeting on the 4th goes. Perhaps after we've had our summer break, it'd be lovely to hear more from you.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, we caught the body of it. And again, it is one that there's layers and nuance. And I think we've touched on the whole thing with GPs and lists and the fact that, very interesting against the backdrop of the narrative of privatising the NHS, the fact that doctor surgeries have always been run as private businesses, which I thought was interesting. The other one, which I'd definitely like to unpack some more of when we get Matt on, is that the tone came across very strongly in that brief interview for me, that virtual consultations very bad, face-to-face consultations very good. And I'm not sure that I agree with that.
To be fair to him, that's in the interest of time. That's one of the things that we discussed kind of later on, that he did go on to explain that in an ideal world, actually, you'd have a service that enabled patients to engage with it in whichever way was the most convenient and effective for them, whether that would be a telephone or a Zoom consultation, or whether that's in person, whatever their needs are, depending on their particular needs or their particular ailment or condition. So to be fair to him, that's not actually what he actually went on to say. So cool. Really interesting to have him back on and have a bit more time. Just to quickly mention, Rob in the comments is saying that access to NHS dentistry is more of an issue in Portsmouth. He says he's phoned about 50 dental practices to register without success, and this needs fixing as soon as possible. So, you know, if there's a solution here for GPs, could that work for the dentistry?
Yeah,
you know, that's a good one.
Yeah, no, and that's one which definitely doesn't work on a Skype or a Zoom call. No. So yeah, no, definitely one for us to pick up and explore. Now I think it would be fair to say that there was a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing, but ultimately that proposal passed.
I don't think it was really a surprise that it passed unanimous, but it did pass without there was a Labour amendment that fell 16 to 18. So that didn't get subsumed into the original motion and wasn't accepted outright by the Liberal Democrats. So the original motion as submitted was passed unanimously by the council, and that was quite a significant theme of the meeting.
Yes.
And whether again that was the nature of the submissions or whether that was the discomfort of the day, I don't know. Let's get a councillor on and ask them.
Absolutely. So that perhaps wasn't one that that was one top of Labour's wins for the day, but they had other motions which seemed to go much better. So let's welcome Councillor Graham Heaney to give us a Labour perspective.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on. Do you want me to just say a little bit about the meeting generally, then I'll just talk about our three motions. Yeah.
I think we
generally take the view that we try to have one main speaker for each item on the basis that you just don't really need about three or four, because if you can make the argument in 6 minutes, you should be able to do it, you know. Sometimes other parties follow, sometimes they don't, but we were very clear about that as well. And I think the heat of the day probably did have some effect, that people didn't want to be there for, you know, nine or ten hours. But actually, I think there was also a degree of consensus. I mean, if I just turn to the three motions that we actually put forward and focus on them, happy to talk about others, but I just want to focus on those ones. The first one that we put forward was my colleague Charlotte Gerardo and Judith Smythe on phasing out pesticides and weed killers. Now, this is an issue we've taken up before, and the council has come back on it, but there did seem to be a bit of reluctance to really proceed with this within a sort of reasonable time frame, which is why we brought it back. I think it's an awareness as well. I think we've become much more aware now that when we put stuff into the environment, it doesn't just disappear. It sometimes stays there, and sometimes it gets reconstituted into something else, and sometimes that doesn't produce good results. I'm no scientist, not a science scientist, but, you know, but I have followed and been interested in environmental issues for a long time. So I know that, you know, what we put into our environment, you know, does get recycled in all sorts of ways, sometimes in terms of pollution and whatever. So I think we have to think really carefully about what we put into the environment. We're getting more and more evidence that some of the pesticides and weed killers that we've used over the years have been really, really, really detrimental. I think Charlotte quoted a book by Rachel Carson called Silent Spring, written back in the 60s. She was an American scientist. And I read that book when I was at school, actually, and it was quite interesting because she actually pointed out how some of the chemicals that were being used in the 40s and 50s were having hugely detrimental effects on wildlife, on the environment, you know, things like DDT and so on. And they were long-term poisons that stayed around in the environment for years and then got into the food chain and then affected other species. So that was the problem. Now, the thing about Rachel Carson was that she was one of the first to really raise this as a scientist and got a lot of pushback from the chemical industry as well, you know, at the time against this, you know. But now I think we've become much more aware, much more sensitive to this issue. So the motion was really asking the council to effectively take a lead, because I think local authorities as public organisations representing the community should do that, in looking to try and remove these as far as possible and find alternative methods. And there was a lot of detail in the amendment. I won't go into all the detail, but really what it was about. The second one was around wanting participation in local democracy. We're obviously aware that the turnout in local elections is relatively low compared to general elections, at least, and has been for some time. And we are also aware that changes to the way in which people present at elections and providing ID is going to potentially put some challenges for people who don't have photo ID or maybe don't think about it as something they need for election purposes. But this is slightly wider, I suppose, because we did have some conversations, and it came out of some conversations that colleagues had with the Learning Disability Forum about the partnership about this. And we recognise that people with disabilities don't always get access. Either material is not accessible to them because they can't access it easily, or if you are partially sighted, you know, you can't read a leaf that goes pushed through your door, you know. So we need to think about these things more. And one of the suggestions in the motion was that we would hold an event, get the group leaders to hold an event for people with learning disabilities through the partnership, to have an event where we could present and people could ask questions and hear people's views, and that would be a way of creating an accessible event. But we're also asking the council to have a look at a report on what else can be done to try and make sure that local democracy is accessible, people's ability to participate in it. So that was really important too. The final one was...
I guess looking at that one though, Graham, just if we can interject there, obviously if you're looking for, you know, at any point for two local political podcasters to moderate such events, then you have a couple of willing volunteers.
Well,
that would
that's a really good offer. Yes, I'm sure that's something we could certainly bear in mind, and I'll make sure that that gets passed on to the people who are doing the review. So that will be certainly something we'd welcome. So thank you very much for that.
And it sounded like there was pretty much unanimous support for both of those.
Yes, I mean I think. Doesn't matter what party you are, you want people to participate in the democratic process and to make their views known, and be able to express their choices about who is representing them. So we really, really want that. We don't want to see low turnouts. We want as many people as possible. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why people don't, but trying to find ways in which we can make it easier for people to do that is really important for local democracy. The final one was somewhat ironic. Because as the mover Judith Smyth said, on the hottest day of the year so far, we were putting a motion forward that people ought to be able to find warm places to go to, rather than cool places to go to. But this was really an anticipation of what is likely to happen in the autumn, when we know energy prices are likely to go up and people are really going to struggle to pay their heating bills. And if you are, maybe not working, or you have health problems and you're at home, keeping your heating on all day may be really a struggle. So the idea was that we would ask the City Council to do some preparatory work, to work with volunteers, basically looking at the sort of support people gave to other people during COVID, the sort of collective support that everyone gave to people, trying to mobilise that to help in the winter, so that people have got warm places to go to. So it could be churches, community centres, libraries, etc. Now, I know libraries do actually provide a nice place for people to go if you can't heat your home, you're going to spend all day in the library reading a book or whatever. That's a really nice thing to do. So it's not that we don't do that, but we need probably to make it a bit, maybe people a bit more aware of it, because some people might feel that, well, that's not what I should use the library for. Well, yeah, maybe you should, and maybe churches can get involved and other community organisations can do that. So the purpose of the motion was really to do some preparatory work to make that possibility available for people to cope with the potential problems that the increase in energy bills will cause from as the winter comes in from October onwards.
And this is something we got quite excited about on the podcast last time when we reviewed it, because I think it is interesting, isn't it? Because it also touches to a motion that just came before about the fact that the civic offices are now perhaps underutilized as more people are working from home. And I think I shared on the last podcast, I now have other people working with me from home, so there is almost a mini office hub in my house. But when I worked from home back in 2018, nobody else in my household did. So I would quite often find myself sat here with the dog, at sort of 8:15 when everybody's left, and it'll be 6 o'clock before anybody else turns up. So and that's great, because I've got a family, but I think we have got a new segment of society who perhaps are going to be at home all the time, and as you say, to keep the heating on is going to be a bit of a challenge. So it sounds like this is this was a motion that everybody could get behind, in terms of not just about the cost of living, but in terms of creating more community hubs where perhaps those that are feeling a bit of social isolation have got a place to go that's warm and welcoming.
Yeah, I think that's right. As I say, if you are on your own and you don't go out very much, and you're retired, you may have not brilliant health, being able to go somewhere like that could actually increase your social interaction. You meet new people you wouldn't have met otherwise, because you've gone there to be warm, and you felt able to go there. So that can be another bonus. I think you touched on a really interesting point about people working from home, because there's an interesting feature of home working where we used to go to nice warm offices. Now the cost of heating is being put on the employee who's having to heat their home. So there's a bit of an issue there, I suppose, emerging too. Employers are not having to pay for the heating because the employees, a lot of them, are working at home. But that's another issue.
Yes, no, and it is, as I say, there's two of us now in the house who work for the same organisation, and so, you know, we're here heating, lighting, you know, even putting the kettle on to make a cup of tea. All of that comes off of my electricity bill now, rather than the organisation's, which, you know, you can argue is you offset that against the cost of travel to and from a, you know, a place of work. So there is a bit of quid pro quo in there, but it's definitely something that needs considering.
Yes,
So the motion wasn't initially universally applauded, was it? Although there was quite a consensus of agreement, there was an amendment, a Conservative amendment submitted that sought to put in some of the things that central government were doing, but that wasn't subsumed, and it was lost 11-20. So that wasn't, so the original motion was then just carried unanimously anyway. So it was, I guess, one of those things of, is that kind of quite normal that that someone will try to make an amendment, but even when that doesn't work, they'll just vote for it anyway?
I think the amendment was very minor. It wasn't really, and I don't think it really made a significant difference to the motion. It didn't really add anything significant to it. So I don't think my colleague was willing to accept it. And ultimately, it wasn't enough for the Conservatives who put the amendment to vote against it. They sometimes we put an amendment forward, which we'd like to see to improve the motion. Doesn't mean that if we don't get our amendment accepted, we won't vote for it, you know, because we probably genuinely agree with it, but we want to add something which we think is useful. So we asked some questions about the GP motion, for example. And basically we're just asking about, well, some of the things that were proposed in 2020 don't seem to have happened, you know, couldn't we sort of revisit these again? And that didn't really sort of fly. So we weren't gonna make a big thing of it. We were happy to support the motion, even though our amendment didn't go through.
So in terms of the meeting as a whole, Graham, it appeared that there was mostly harmony and highlights. Any lowlights for yourself, or are you heading into the summer break now pretty pleased with everything that went on?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I think it was okay. I wasn't quite sure why the Conservatives wanted to have a go at me for supporting them in their motion on park homes. We're all basically, you know, rowing in the same direction, but that, I think, was refighting an old battle going back to the local elections and the council budget meeting. But, you know, that's just one of these things that happens. So there we are.
Yeah, the park homes was one we got fairly lively about in terms, but very quickly, which is that, you know, the more you look at the park homes issue, the fact that, you know, I can't believe that anybody thinks it's a good idea. And, you know, I think in the end, the Lib Dems couldn't bring themselves to vote against their own original decision, but I think they all abstained rather than...
Well, that was bizarre because they actually didn't support their own original decision. They all sat on their hands and didn't vote for it. So I think that is a token that they are going to make a change. They're going to, you know, maybe it may take a little while for them to reverse it, but I think they are going to do it. It's just a question of when, not if. I think the sooner they do it, the better, because, to be honest, I don't think the residents of Cliftdale or Ms. Bart should be left hanging in limbo for another few months while we sort of laboriously go through reversing the decision. I think it's very clear that it's not something that's supported. And obviously we as a councillors at the council meeting can't vote things down. We don't have that power now to do those sorts of things. It's up to the cabinet to decide, or cabinet members. So the sooner they do that, the better.
Yeah. Perfect. But the administration defence that was put up for it in the meeting from Councillor Sanders didn't really seem to fly that much or last that long. From a perspective of, he tried to make a defence, but then checked with his officers, who then told him that it wasn't the case that the council was going to get sued. I couldn't remember whether it was Scott Peter Harris or Terry Norton that had challenged him on the. Sorry, you're trying to suggest that there's a resident that's in favour of this that's in the parks.
Yeah, it was rather confusing. I mean, he suggested that there were some residents. There were some consultations done back in 2006 where there were a number of options put to the residents, which involved selling the mobile home parks, increasing the pitch fees, putting on the charge. And I think some of the ones there thought they don't want those options, so they might be prepared to accept a charge. I think that was the thing. Because I went back and looked at all the original documents. It's my historian's training of not relying on secondary sources, going back and look at the original documents if you can. And to be honest, I was astonished when Gaz's Island said that, that people could be sued. I mean, it's just a complete load of nonsense. I don't know where he got that from, and I'm very glad he quickly managed to correct the record. And officer said, "No, you do. We can't be sued. It's not a decision."
Marvellous. Harmony reached in the end. Exactly. So bless you, sir. Have a great summer. We're going to have to move on to the next section, but thank you for coming on and giving us that perspective.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Bye. Thank you, Graham. So, yeah, common sense and harmony.
We agreed, you know, if I'm supporting all three Labour motions, which I think I did in the in last week's, there's got to be some good in there, hasn't there? So,
there was the interesting exchange for me was in the bit about the civic offices, where which was the Conservative motion, and unfortunately I've got to hold my hands up to that.
I've been very poor. It's very late getting invites out. So the fact that we haven't
unfortunately we weren't able to secure a Conservative representative tonight. But their motion about basically about the civic offices and reviewing their use or potential future uses or potential future development. The Conservatives accepted the Lib Dem amendment. But refused to accept the Labour amendment. But the Labour amendment was simply to remove the sentence that said the council regrets that the Liberal Democrats haven't ensured the return to normal in the civic offices. Now, the Liberal Democrats themselves didn't put that in their amendment, but Labour did put it in theirs, wasn't subsumed, wasn't automatically accepted by the proposer of the motion. But the amendment itself was carried anyway, so it was just this kind of to and fro, and then basically the substantive, so the thus amended motion then passed unanimously anyway.
Wouldn't be a proper council meeting without some pointless bickering over wording, would it?
But it was strange that the bickering, as you call it, was actually the Labour Party calling out, asking to remove a sentence that actually attacked the Liberal Democrats, that the Liberal Democrats didn't seem to have been bothered enough to ask to have removed in their own amendment.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Marvellous.
You know, hey-ho.
Next guest.
So next.
We do like George.
Hello.
Good evening, George.
Do we call you Councillor Madgwick the Younger these days, or are we still going with George?
Just Councillor Madgwick. Brian, call him senior. Yeah, it's fine.
Marvellous. So how was your fun in the sun on Tuesday, George?
You know what? It was pretty good. Bearing in mind the heat was incredible for the part, it wasn't too bad.
And you had a couple of motions on the agenda, on the notices of motions. Positive highlights?
Yeah, forward to the licensing border region. And it's something I say, it's my first, and it was something that I found really important, because in our city currently, from Wolverhampton, is my the ability for us as a council to license trade in our city, and really does pose, it was something that was massively important to us. And obviously
Sorry, George, just checking there. I don't know whether Ian, are you getting the same thing?
Lost George.
Got George's audio chopping in and out.
Yeah, and I've lost him now.
Can you still hear us all right, George? It seems that it cuts in and out. It's like it doesn't pick up the first thing you say. I don't know whether the echo cancellation is actually cancelling you out. You're being cancelled, George.
Let me try something.
If you've got earphones, that might help, if you've by any chance got any to hand.
Well, you're just playing with that, George. If we look at some of the motions which I think are perhaps too dull to that aren't going to come up. So the thing on banks in North End got unanimously voted through, even though I don't think we were that keen on it.
I don't think we were, from a perspective of what power does the council have to do anything other than say to the banks, could you please sit down and talk to us about this? Welcome back, George. Hopefully that works.
Hello, is that any better?
Oh, that does, yeah.
Yeah.
That does seem better.
Good.
Yeah. Okay, yes, good. Thank you for that. So, yeah, a couple of motions from the Pips, which was really good to see on there. Your motion about the cross-border licensing, that was quite heavily amended by the Conservatives. They pretty much did a wholesale rewrite and added about three more pages to it for you, didn't they?
Added a few paragraphs, yeah. But the Conservatives approached me a good few weeks beforehand. Yeah. I sent the motion to them way in advance of the council meeting for their opinion. I sent it to Labour as well as Liberals as well. And the Conservatives come back to me and said they'd like to make some changes. And they brought the changes to me way before the council meeting for me to look at, read and see if I was happy with. So although it seems like it was like an out of the blue amendment, it was something that we worked on, agreed on prior to the council meeting.
Because there's a deadline, isn't there, for you submitting the original motion. And obviously, if you need to then edit that, you can't edit it after the event. So your opportunity to do that is the amendment, isn't it?
Yeah. So in my original motion, I wanted to keep the name of the people out. I didn't want to name Wolverhampton, and I didn't want to name other licensing authorities. But the Conservatives really did want to name them. And I don't say that necessarily as bad. It's just that I prefer to keep it ambiguous and a bit kind of more discreet. And they wanted a name and shame them, really. So that was really the idea.
And I guess to
it.
That end, George, when we were talking about this last week, you know, I was sort of slightly perplexed in terms of, you know, the Hackney Carriage arrangements means that, you know, if you're a private hire driver, you can't pick people up off the street or you can't go and park on the rank. So I'm guessing these people who are licensed in out of city authorities, are they sort of then working on one of the national platforms like Uber, or, you know,
No, they're currently they're exclusively to Aqua, which is something that's really disappointing.
Right. So,
Aqua,
so having killed off every other taxi company in Portsmouth, Aqua are now potentially wheeling and
moving their drivers out of our city. Yeah, yeah, it's a real shame. It is a real shame, and hopefully we can work with them to get them back to our city. I mean, it's just that Wolverhampton is so easy to apply for. You know, I don't know if you listened in that day, but you know, they approved 15,000 applications in 1 year a couple of years ago. You know, it's and they're approving them from all over, from Truro up to Edinburgh. They're approving licenses for, you know, and it's just so easy to get a license in Wolverhampton. There's no real restrictions. They haven't got to do CCTV. There's a lot of things they can skip, and especially with the vehicles. I say we as an authority don't let any vehicles that are over, I think it's 4 years and 6 months, come through. However, theirs is 11 years. Wow. It's mind-blowing. I don't know if you saw the photo that I held up, but it was of a Vauxhall Corsa, a 10-year-old Vauxhall Corsa driving around in our city. You know, that is not a safe vehicle and a comfortable vehicle under the licensing conditions, yep, in our opinion. So it's just a lot easier in Wolverhampton. You can get a lot cheaper, easier cars through the back door. You haven't got to look after them or maintain them as well. There's a lot of things and a lot of benefits to having a taxi out of city. And it's a real shame. And we need to tighten down on that, especially, as I say, especially because of the safety aspect. Because, you know, if somebody calls our licensing authority and says, I've had an issue with a taxi driver, blah, blah, we can't do anything. We can't call that taxi driver in for review. We can't do anything. There's no enforcement action. So
no,
it's
did
really
a piece
bad.
Of work probably 6 or 7 years ago now on behalf of the licensing authority, strolling about the city with my guide dog, seeing whether people would give us any issues and access refusals. And, the vast majority were great. But, you know, even then there were still people who and you hear it regularly that, I'm allergic. Well, have you got a medical exemption certificate? It's all gone quiet. So no, good to see that one through. let's hope for some action on that. And then Hilsey Community Centre.
Fundamentally, Russell, Councillor Simpson, went around and obviously did a lot of door knocking in his campaigning. And I said to him as he's going around, you know, write up all the issues. So as you're going around, you know, highlight the majority of the issues. And a certain demographic was saying about a community centre or lack of one. And it's something that surprised me because I didn't realise there was a need for it. But I'm not a Hilsey resident, so I wouldn't necessarily know that.
there seems to be a desire for one now. And I don't think there was a couple of decades ago, but it seems to have changed slightly. So, yeah, fingers crossed they can start moving on that, looking at locations and stuff. But obviously these are things all come with affordability. Mm. You know, how do we afford a community centre and so on and so forth? So I think there's got to be some work done on that motion, but it's good to start the ball rolling at least.
Yeah, no.
I must admit that was the angle that we took it when we looked at it. Thanks, Ian. When we looked at it last week, you know, our kind of thought process was: would you normally kind of start looking for a venue or a location before you've kind of identified a pot of money that you can use to kind of do it? But is this just the way you kind of need to do it because the you know, not build it, design it, and the money will come? Is that kind of the...
Yeah, the issue is with a lot of things in Portsmouth at the moment is available open space or available buildings or available land, you know, and different bits of land cost different bits of money. So it's really hard to determine how much money you specifically need for a project nowadays without having the idea or notion, at least, of where you're going to put these things. It's one of the issues I've faced in Paulsgrove, or facing in Paulsgrove currently, the current community centre, of whether they're going to move it or knock this one down, build another. And the question does always originate around money. But I think this is a very early stage motion. You know, it's a very, very early stage. It's not something that's been considered for decades, as that was made clear in the full council. So initially, it's a feasibility. Let's see if, one, it's relevant and needed, and where can we put it? And then, as I say, when the full council... full budget comes up next year, we can start to see whether there's a plausible money pot for it or how that could possibly work. But with anything like a community project or a community centre, these things take years. It's not an overnight job. So having the foundations there, at least, is quite a reasonable first step.
Is it something where you might look to work with existing kind of facilities that are within the ward? Full disclosure, I'm a member of Portsmouth Rugby Club, you know, which is very busy on a Saturday. And you know, they are starting to host some community events. You know, is that something that could be considered to utilize those kind of spaces, which perhaps aren't active 100%. 7 days a week?
Yeah, we don't have to build a new centre if there's something available. You know, we don't have to do that. You know, and this is about looking at the land, because there is some options, and options that I didn't even know existed, hidden away and tucked away in nice locations. We do own a significant amount of property in Hilsey. Some things are used as big storage yards. We've got Councillor Simpson will be able to tell you the exact details, but he did show me, and we own a big brick building, and it's in the middle of Hilsey, literally smack bang in the middle. It's a great building, a great location. Currently, we use it for storage. You know, we've got a lot of space in the civic offices we could use for storage. So, you know, there could be options where we look at existing buildings to keep the cost down and to make it more viable.
Okay, another one to watch then. What were you also kind of weighed in on the Park Homes conversation, kind of calling out the hold on of the conversations about trying to say that, well, the Park Home residents aren't subject to stamp duty, which is normally what, about 3%, but this charge is 10%, so you know.
Yeah, do you know what? It's that was the most contentious issue of the day, as you probably know, because everything else was sailing through quite easily. I've never known a full council be so amicable the whole way through. And then Park Homes come up and all hell broke loose, and suddenly we had an hour and a half debate. But, you know, I said, if you did listen in, I said very openly that we were going in there against the motion. We were fully going in there against the motion. Our philosophy was, I mean, don't get me wrong, we also went into the meeting thinking, because we were told that there was a legal ramification if we didn't. So obviously that was clarified during the meeting, as Councillor Heaney just said. We thought that was a position that would be a legal ramification. We also looked at the stamp duty element. We looked at different elements of it. And going into that meeting, we were 100% voting against it. There was no ifs, buts or maybes. And then we had a brilliant deputation or representation at the beginning of the meeting from a gentleman called John, who lives on site. And it was my father, Brian Madgwick, next to me, who turned around and went, not too sure about voting against it now. And I was like, right, we need to have a chat about this. So we had a chat outside. And what we then did is, during the little breaks and intervals, we went to speak to the Conservatives and just find out a little bit more. Because the thing is, and it is a really difficult thing as a councillor, is you're expected to know everything about everything, you know, at a drop of a hat. And it's not realistic. You know, we don't know the intricacies of this Park Home debate. You know, we don't know everything, you know. So I pulled in Lee Mason. I spoke to Lee and I said, look, come on, just be blunt. Tell me why we should vote for it. You know, give me the... And he said one really simple thing to me, and this is what changed my mind. He said, you own a house, don't you? I said, yeah, I do own a house. He said, wonderful. He said, imagine if I come to you tomorrow and told you I'm taking 10% off you as soon as you sell it. How, what would you react like? And I was like, I'd blow up and go mad. And that's literally the first thing I thought. And I thought, right, okay, this is fair enough. You know, these people bought these sites. You know, it's irrespective of every other councillor in the country other than five implement a charge. You know, these people bought their park homes without the knowledge or without the foresight that they would be charged this 10%. So it's really kind of awful for them to turn around and all of a sudden chuck this 10% on. And also 10% is incredibly high. I spoke to the, actually, I won't tell you who I spoke to, but I spoke to one of the legal advisors prior. And I said, did it have to be 10%? And they said, no, it could have been 2 or 3%. I thought, well, that I could agree with because, you know, as homeowners, we pay stamp duty. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the fact they don't pay stamp duty, I think that if they said, look, 2, 3%, I think that would be fair and at least justifiable. But 10% is a massive stretch. And I think that was too far. And that's why we ended up voting for the motion. And I hope, I mean, I'm a big Councillor Sanders fan. I mean, since day one, he took me under his wing and he showed me the ropes as an independent when I had nobody else to go there. So I'm a big Darren fan. And I think as a cabinet member for housing, I think he probably is the best option out of all 42 councillors. I honestly can't rate the guy highly enough. But his speech to justify it was rubbish, you know, and I know Councillor Heaney brought it up, but saying people liked it and there was it was really, really poor. And hopefully now the Liberal Democrats will pull back on this and revert it back to its original status because it's clearly not got support of the council.
Yeah, it was. I have to. I mean, we're both fans of Darren's as well. We've had him on the podcast several times, and he's always been really good and engaging and giving us really good, thorough answers to why X, Y, Z, why things work a particular way. Sadly, those skills didn't seem to be with him in his intervention in the chamber on Tuesday. It was only one of two recorded votes on the day. Everything else was all of the other business was done unanimously. So it's quite clearly an issue. I mean, we said last week it's just giving. To be honest with you, I can't understand. It seems to be the administration just giving the Conservatives something to campaign on in Eastleigh and Craneswater and in Cosham. But there it is. But maybe if the day is, maybe if the room isn't as comfortable in future, maybe even a packed agenda like Tuesday's, you can get through it as in 6 3/4 hours instead of being there till nearly midnight. Maybe that's the way to go.
It would be nice. And you know, on a separate thing, because I watched Councillor Heaney, and obviously, you know, the Conservatives did have a mini attack on him for putting through the budget in March. But, you know, and I voted through the budget as well. But I think it's very important to understand that when we're voting for a budget, we're voting for a whole budget. Yeah. You know, we're not voting for an individual thing. And I think that's maybe one of the weaknesses in the system. You know, I don't think that stereotypically Labour or myself or Claire and Jeanette Smith would have probably voted for that thing if it was a standalone issue. But it wasn't. We had to vote on a full budget, you know, and that's the things that people got to remember. It's difficult. And did we want to sit there at 11 o'clock at night and say, right, now rewrite the whole budget because of this one topic, you know, which, by the way, was very well hidden within the budget. It was a very little sneaky hidden thing that was put in there. And that's what people got to remember. You vote for a whole thing, not an individual topic. And I didn't overly like the dig at Labour about that. Because, as I say, it was a difficult position for us all to be in. Yeah, but we couldn't decline a whole budget because of one tiny little
That would seem kind of strange at the last minute. Just say, no, throw out the whole 600-page document or whatever it is and start again. We're starting again on a new blank piece of paper. That's just not really kind of how it works. Yeah. But there is also political point scoring made of this party voted against XYZ and it is just a small part of the budget. So maybe some politicking and point scoring about that doesn't serve anybody in the long run, does it? But no, well,
so time. Thanks very much. Time for the summer, George, and a bit of time off, or more wrestling with different councils over Fareham Way.
Yeah, well, yes. You've probably seen the news. Seen the news. I'm in my own review tomorrow. The tables have turned, so I'm having my own review tomorrow, but. you know, luckily for me, the experience as being a councillor in this council, especially with my role on licensing, it's given me a full pack of ammo to go in there with. You know, I know what I'm talking about now. And I tell you what, tune in at 10 o'clock in the morning, because it should be incredibly interesting.
It should be a lively one. Well, best of luck with that, George. And hopefully we'll see you in the autumn.
Wonderful. Best wishes, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.
So
we're nearly there before we go to a summer break ourselves. We're going to take August off, come back in September.
Yes, indeed.
What else has happened this week? Has there been something else going on this week?
Sadness. General sadness. So this is where I take off my hat of neutrality and put on my rather fetching conservative hat, which is probably a tricorn hat of some sort. So the leadership process. Again, all the way through, I was very encouraged by it. I thought it was very positive to see a very diverse group of candidates putting their hat in the ring, you know, to be the Conservative leader. I watched some of the debates and I thought many of the contenders gave really good accounts of themselves. There were two that I really didn't care for. I thought that Rishi appeared very sort of disingenuous, and the words spoken didn't really play through with the actions. And I thought that Liz Truss was very kind of wooden in her delivery and looked for me a little bit out of her depth. And but I think I called it fairly on in the piece as things were shaping up. My worry was always going to be that as a member, I was going to be left with a choice of Rishi or Liz. And that is exactly what's happened. So Penny was in second spot all the way along. And then the final allocation of votes saw a slip to third. So in the spirit of democracy, the membership doesn't get to vote for Penny, which is extremely frustrating, and because she would have won the vote and would be our next Prime Minister.
So have the Conservative Party, have the Conservative Parliamentary Party handed the next general election to the Labour Party then?
That is my fear, if I'm honest, Simon. So there is an element of, Rishi has made his personal wealth. His wife has an extraordinary wealth. But again, to the backdrop of that, legally pays all the tax that she should do in India and in the UK. So I know she's been made out to be all non-dom tax. So there's an element for, Rishi and his wife are a very wealthy family. So for me, the standing there and saying, we've got to keep fiscal prudence and we don't want to leave a debt to our children and our children's children, basically rings hollow from a man and his wife who are worth potentially the best parts of £750 million. So I find taking that line, and the councillor, the chap who went chancellor, was giving away money like there was no tomorrow during the pandemic, now to stand and give that, times are hard, we're gonna have to tighten our belts, again rings hollow. And similarly, Liz Truss for me is looking to play to the to the party faithful, taking this sort of very hard line approach. But for me, I worry about both of them being able to defeat Keir Starmer at the next election. They've got 2 years to turn around the integrity mess that I fear that Boris has left the party in. And for me, Rishi as a candidate who was his right hand man, that doesn't look great. And again, somebody who's copped the fine themselves, and Liz also is another one of his front benchers. And it does sadden me that, the parliamentary party were very, very aware of who the best candidate was, who the membership wanted, and they have chosen not to give us the option to elect that candidate. And it plays to the last election. If you look at it, the members were given the option of Boris or an arch Remainer that wished to prolong the agonies of exiting the EU. You know, there were two strong Brexit candidates, Michael Gove and Boris, but there's an element of Michael was never going to be allowed to be on the ballot paper just in case he won.
Well, I find it, as an observer, I find it, I find it mildly horrifying, but from a out of curiosity perspective, I find it interesting that both the parliament, when both parties had leadership elections, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, obviously most recently,
yep,
the parliamentary parties seemed to have a different view as to who they thought was the right candidate than what the membership seemed to think. It's interesting the different mechanisms that the two different parties use to select a leader, which is also different to what the Liberal Democrats use to choose the leader. Considering the Conservatives are absolutely adamant that first past the post is the best thing ever, I don't understand why they're not willing to put all of the candidates before the members and ask them to vote for the best candidate. If first past the post is the best one, why gerrymander a decision between the awful and the dreadful when actually there are, other alternatives.
Better candidates that the membership wants. And I think that's the fundamental difference between the two parties as it stands currently is whilst the Parliamentary Labour Party, you know, can get their people onto the list, ultimately it's the National Executive, it's quite a bigger list, and the membership determine the outcome. Whereas obviously, you know, the way in which the process works for the Conservatives is you end up having to call heads or tails. And I think it's going to be a very, to be honest, I don't, you know, there's going to be debates and there's going to be hustings and there's going to be a lot of talk. I think for most members, they've seen enough already. There is an element of, personally, I feel that it's been engineered that, you know, well, you're going to vote for Rishi because you don't want Liz Truss, do you? And there is the contrarian in me that says, well, if you're trying to back me into a corner and you're trying to engineer an outcome, I will not comply.
No, well, if you end up with obviously the turnout figures will see whether that bears fruit. But at the end of the day, that again is the mechanism. I've spoke before about single transferable vote would at least enable you to build a larger grouping of people that support, even if they weren't their preferred candidate, the eventual winner.
Yep.
Instead of building large coalitions of people that hate the winner within your own party, that doesn't seem to be like a long-term recipe for success. But four prime ministers in 6 years. Thank God we didn't vote for all that chaos with Ed Miliband, eh?
Well, who knows where we would have ended up? So, yes, on that rather controversial bombshell, and I will place my X at some point over the summer. We'll be back in September to review who won the race. Brackets, I think it'll be Liz Truss. And we will pick up on lots. We've got plenty planned, but if anybody has any ideas of what they'd like us to cover when we come back, we're always open to those things. You've been listening to the Pompey Politics Podcast. I've been Ian Tiny Morris.
And our guests today have been Matthew Winnington, Graham Heaney and George Madgewick. Thank you all three for joining us, and I've been Simon Sansbury. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast. If you want to make sure you get notifications about upcoming shows and get to know when we're live, we normally broadcast live 6:27 p.m. on a Sunday evening, then follow us on Facebook at Pompey Politics Podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at Pompey Politics 1. Please, if you'd like to, feel free to leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts, and you can even ask Alexa to play the podcast for you. Alexa, play the latest episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Getting Pompey Politics Podcast from Amazon Music.
Alexa,
playing the latest episode.
Stop. See? It's easy.